Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join me from 9 to 10 p.m. for an adventure through sound. Who knows? You might just find your next favorite song.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Good morning, it is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. The Kingston General Hospital Auxiliary has made a significant investment in local healthcare, presenting Kingston Health Sciences Centers with $314,650 at their 120th annual general meeting last week. President of the Auxiliary, Chelsea Reynolds, spoke with CFRC about the accomplishment after difficult years during and following the pandemic.
So leading into COVID, we had been in the middle of a seven-year commitment. And we had pledged $2.5 million. And so it was a little bit of a struggle in 2020, 21, 22 to meet that commitment because things hadn't been, you know, we'd shut down, the cafe was a little bit limited, and so it was hard. And now, yeah, we've ramped right back up and we're back to where we had been pre-COVID. So it's very exciting.
Between the consistent effort, generous donors, and other programs returning, all efforts came together to bring the total back to pre-COVID numbers.
We've been able to open back up our lottery booth. It had closed for COVID, and then we opened again in the fall of 23. So that has helped. And yeah, the cafe has just been a very steady growth again. And we always like to say, like, we really rely on our staff there. And shout out to our manager in particular, who's done a really good job. She's always looking for, you know, fresh and local and, you know, suppliers that she can work with on what we need throughout the year. So that has helped. And our staff, like not our staff, but the staff in the hospital are extremely loyal. Like we have people that line up, you know, they know the specials that are coming up and, you know, they commit to getting their lunches there. So that's fantastic. So yeah, it's just been sort of a, you know, a whole bunch of different things that have, you know, just built back up.
The Auxiliary chose to commit to a selection of items to make an immediate impact, a slight shift after their previous commitment towards redevelopment at the hospital.
So last year, I think we gave, I think it was $250,000. And so then this year, we were able to up it a little bit. But that money went towards redevelopment, which was what that seven-year commitment had been. And now redevelopment is on hold on the hospital's end. And so as a group, we decided we wanted to do something that would be a little more immediate, a little more in action right away kind of thing. So that's why we've gone with the $314,000. We're doing NICU ventilators and we're doing the oncology treatment chairs, and those are things that can be purchased in the short term and, you know, be used right away in the hospital. So
the total allowed them to make significant headway, exceeding expectations.
Like the oncology chairs, there was supposed to be a three-year commitment. They were hoping to get five every year, and we had enough money that we could do all 15. So we can just tick that one off the list and we'll see what comes up next year.
In all, the funds will be used to purchase a point-of-care ultrasound machine for the pediatric program, four NICU ventilators, and 15 oncology treatment chairs. In addition, the KGH Auxiliary is also providing educational funding for KHSC staff through the annual Millennium Bursary Fund, as well as supporting elder life and critical care programs. The group came together at their annual general meeting last week to announce the total and celebrate.
This was our best turnout at our AGM since before COVID as well, because I think everybody was excited to see that amount and to, you know, do you feel like you're part of the group that's working towards something together? And, you know, like I do with the lottery booth and you think, oh, well, you know, it's just a couple hours, a couple times a week, but like every little bit counts and you're contributing. And so, yeah, everybody has been really excited. And I know Dr. Pecora and the staff at the hospital had also come to the meeting and, you know, offered lots of appreciation to our volunteers.
As of July 2nd, 2025, Frontenac Park will be temporarily closed for the expansion of day services at the Adelaide Street Shelter at 38 County Street. The Adelaide Street Shelter is currently in the process of winding down, with closure expected in early 2026. The city has chosen to lease the neighboring park to the shelter's day service provider, Lionhearts, for at least the next 6 months, or until the wind-down process is complete. During this period, the park will be closed to the public, and people not participating in day services will be restricted from entering or using the park. The idea was raised by community members in an Adelaide Near Neighbor workshop held on June 11th. According to the release from the city, it was also requested by shelter users and operators. Recognizing that disruptions in the neighborhood are destabilizing to those who live near the shelter, those who work at the shelter, and those seeking support. Jane Hartley, Director of Housing and Social Services with the city, spoke with CFRC about where the idea originated.
We actually brought kind of neighbors together and did some table activities on, you know, what are the current issues, how can the city support, and action items came out of that. And then also, what's the future once emergency shelter services wind down? What would the community like to see? There was some members of the community that had suggested, you know, that services could be provided there for the individuals that were there. They raised that idea of closing and fencing it to enable them to do that. So it was really an opportunity where kind of both the community, some members of the community and the operator brought that forward. And the city thought, you know, it's a great idea and it's an opportunity to really just to help move people forward and, you know, help them reach their goals, not just in, accessing support services inside, like, you know, support with identification, addiction, mental health referrals, those, you know, housing, obviously, housing search, but just some of those wellness things that really kind of help us with our mental health and keep us connected.
This change will allow Lionhearts to offer expanded programming during the day, such as gardening, educational programs, and outdoor health and wellness activities.
This was an opportunity really to expand those services into the outdoors, which is just wonderful for the people that are accessing the service there. Really just wellness activities, you know, some gardening, fitness, like they're really looking, have some, and looking at what's the art of the possible for supporting people. And it's really, you know, to make that site and to allow them to expand into that space safely, there was a need. That's the need, is that we have to ensure that moving forward, that access to that site is secure and remains safe. And that will be an opportunity for those that are actually seeking shelter service and day service. It'll be available to them, and there won't be any, you know, disruption, concern, or, you know, issues with trying to use the space safely.
The release from the city announcing the closure also notes that people may choose to shelter overnight in other municipal parks and that the emergency shelter system continues to have capacity. The city will be continuing to provide support at the Adelaide Shelter and other locations across the city during this transition period, according to the release. The city will also be continuing community engagement efforts as they plan for the future of shelter services in Kingston.
It's at least 6 months, so or until the wind down of the services. However, afterwards, that's really up to the community. And that's what I think is part of the engagement with the community and the city. That's part of this planning process is, you know, what would the community like to see, and then what's possible for the space.
As construction continues on the new Kintege Language and Cultural Center in Tintinega, it has been announced that the center has received a $486,600 GROW grant provided by the provincial government's Ontario Trillium Foundation to be used for the restoration of nature surrounding the center. TTO is an organization that has developed and delivered Mohawk language programs for two decades. TTO is currently in the process of building their new language and cultural center to house and expand their programming, set to open by fall 2025. Over the next 3 years, the GROW grant will be used for the restoration and conservation of 2 acres of forests, wetlands, and meadows surrounding the site. TTO has partnered with Wintergreen Studios for the project, an environmental center located in South Frontenac that works to preserve natural ecosystems and assists other organizations with conservation and sustainability projects. Dr. Rena Upitis, founding director of Wintergreen Studios, shared how the collaboration between TTO and Wintergreen Studios began and led to the project being funded by the GROW grant.
So our association with TTO started several years ago when the school at Tiantanega brought some of their students to Wintergreen for a spring land art bioblitz event. And they've been coming ever since. And I've come to know Callie Hill, who's the chief executive officer at TTO, quite well. And this fall, we decided that the two of us would sit down and write a grant proposal to the Ontario Trillium Foundation. We were absolutely delighted that the Ontario government was funding something that had to do with land restoration, and thrilled to have a formal way of deepening our partnership with TTO.
Ubitus notes that restoration will be a major undertaking given the current state of the land.
The state of the land now is, I would say, damaged by human use and even abuse over the last long while. Before the building began, it was the Shannonville Fairgrounds, and having a fairground and a fairground with animals is not great for natural landscapes. So the way that the land is right now is it's a giant construction site with lots of sand and gravel and quite a few noxious invasive species that tend to pop up on a construction site. So there's poison parsnips, there are thistles, buckthorn, things that are not conducive to a really diverse and beautiful learning environment. So the land right now, it's not pretty. But once upon a time, it was a place that housed, for example, a lot of milkweed. It was the home to probably most of the monarch butterfly species in the area. So one of the things that we're doing is looking to what used to be there and conserving and regenerating that land so that those kinds of species can thrive again.
The Wintergreen team is already at work, breaking ground just after their launch last week, carefully mapping the current landscape and strategically determining how to restore balance.
We have a number of people who are well-versed in plant life, particularly local and native species and near native species. And we have already started to do a very intense inventory of the plants that are there. Our goal is to ensure that there's a invisible boundary between the existing ecology and what we help with in terms of restoration, so that the whole thing becomes seamless.
The restoration will be led by Indigenous ecological knowledge, emphasizing native plants' traditional uses and learning with the land.
And the emphasis, as I said, is on local plants. We're also going to be helping with traditional gardens, medicine gardens, greenhouse, any way we can really to restore the land to what it would have been had a building not popped up in the middle of it. It's a delicate kind of massaging of what's there and what could be introduced so that over time the land takes care of itself.
TTO and Wintergreen are already considering ways the land can be integrated into learning at the center.
One of the things that we're looking at planting is nut trees, and nut trees that are natural to that area. So that brings into possibility planting, harvesting, preserving, eating all kinds of foods that a food forest can produce. So there's many connections with the work that the center will do with the land itself.
These efforts will take time, far longer than the 3-year grant period. But both organizations are looking forward to the journey ahead.
Well, restoration work takes a long time. We will have, if you'll excuse the pun, the seeds of the project in place at the end of 3 years. But it'll take 20 or 30 years for the landscape to do its own work. And in terms of when we start to see things, immediately. We've received the go-ahead. We've had our official launch. And the day of the launch, we had people from Wintergreen out on the land doing surveys and having conversations and discussions about what to plant this summer and what to plant this coming fall.
Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
Thank you. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We're looking at a rainy start to the week for Monday, July 7th, with a 75% chance of precipitation in the morning, becoming humid and cloudy into the afternoon with a daytime high of 24 degrees. Tuesday, July 8th, we're going to see a daytime high of 25 with mostly sunny conditions, a very small 25% chance of precipitation at times, but it should be a beautiful day. Wednesday, July 9th. Warmest day of the week. We've got a daytime high of 27 with high humidity and sunny conditions projected here in the city of Kingston. Thursday, July 10th, daytime high of 24 degrees, a 90% chance of precipitation. It's going to be warm and humid here in the city of Kingston. Friday, July 11th, daytime high of 25, feeling closer to 31 thanks to the high humidity. Saturday, July 12th, a high of 25. It's going to be a beautiful sunny day. Perfect start to your weekend. Sunday, July 13th, daytime high of 25, cloudy all day with some light cloud coverage into the afternoon. And then starting off next week, Monday, July 14th, 27 degrees, high UV index, lots of sun in the forecast. Here is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed on the following dates: July 6th, 13th, 20th and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th and 31st, and September 7th. All of these days, it will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Shifting now to the fall, some select locations when the LaSalle Causeway will also be closed from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. September 21st, October 5th, 14th and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th. Here are your road closures for the week. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Carlton Street, Alfred to Guy is closed June 30th to August 8th for a gas main installation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Guy Street, Carlton 2 Division is also closed June 30th to August 8th for gas main installation. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence is closed beginning July 10th at 12:01 a.m. until July 14th at 7 a.m. for Busker's Rendezvous. And Johnson Street at Victoria is closed beginning July 9th at 6:30 a.m. until July 10th at 6:30 p.m. for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Accommodation Road, 6th Concession to White Church, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Abbeydon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Catterockway Woods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic is down to one lane in each direction. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Garrett Road, 6th Concession to Sandhill, expect delays while a contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Highway 2 to Abbeydon and St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road. And White Church Road, 6th Concession to Woodburn, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. In a
red carrier, an animal that looks like a cross between a squirrel and a raccoon, but unlike anything native to Canada, it looks grumpy. He certainly sounds grumpy, and rightfully so. He's over 3,000 kilometers away from home, and he didn't exactly buy a ticket. Sandy Pines Wildlife Center in Napanee recently welcomed an unexpected guest last month, whose journey is still unfolding. The story began after receiving a call from a manufacturer reporting a strange animal found in a shipping container. Sue Meach, director of Sandy Pines, recounts the unusual call they received on the evening of June 16th.
We got a call from some people in Belleville that worked at an auto parts store. They said that they had a Mexican raccoon in a bin, and it had been there for a day, and they put some water in, but they didn't know what to do with it.
Sandy Pines volunteer Greg Oosting was sent to investigate the next day. What he found was certainly not a raccoon, but needed help nonetheless.
I said, be prepared for what you see. I'm really not sure what this is, but we need to help the animal. Anyway, he got there and he said, well, this isn't a raccoon, but I'm going to catch it anyway. And it's going to die if it stays in here. So he was able to trap it. And then it was brought into us by a volunteer.
Once at the center, staff quickly identified the visitor as a caco mussel, a small nocturnal mammal native to Central America, characterized by its dark-ringed tail.
It's a very small mammal. It's only weighs less than a kilogram, so it's very small, about half the size of a cat, maybe a six-month-old kitten. And it has a long tail with beautiful gray and white stripes, or black and white stripes, actually, all the way up. At first, we were told it was a lemur. But when we did our homework and started looking it up online, we realized that it couldn't be a lemur because lemurs come from Africa. So we did a bit of research and discovered that there was a similar species in South America or Central America. And it was commonly known as a ringtail, but the technical name is a caco mussel. So it arrived, and at least we knew what we were getting, and we were prepared somewhere for him. They like trees to climb, so we had a barn stall set up with trees in it, branches in it that have been donated by very generous people who trim their trees and bring branches in for our animals. And we set up a nice little den in there for him, and in he went. Apparently, the company in Belleville makes headlights for vehicles, and they pack up the headlights in sea cans and send them to Mexico. Mexico then sends back the empty sea can, and somehow this little guy, I can see how he's so small, if he'd gotten into the corner of a really big sea can in the dark, when you looked in, you wouldn't spot him right away.
While the stowaway was frightened, it was coping well under the unusual circumstances. The question now was how to return it home, or at the very least, to a safe environment.
So then it was the dilemma of what is the legal process for handling a situation like this. We did have this happen once with a bird. We had an albatross here many years ago that was not indigenous to Canada. So, but that was with Canadian Wildlife Services that do the avian species. So I reached out to the Ministry of Natural Resources, and who I'm a custodian. I have a license under their authority. And they said, well, it wasn't their department, called the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with animals crossing the border, apparently, whether they're exotics or food animals that are coming in. Anyway, they laughed when I called them and said, well, it's funny that you should call us, because we got a call from Belleville and they said to bring the animal to you and call you. So I was going round in circles here.
Meach began reaching out for guidance and suggestions. Eventually, she connected with Lee Parker, zoo director at Little Rays Nature Center, an exotic animal rescue located in Ottawa.
But I have a friend who's a vet in Ottawa, and she had told me that she works with exotics. So I explained to her that we had this caca missile, and we were quite happy to give him temporary accommodation, but obviously he needed something more than we could give him, maybe even try to get him back to Mexico. Anyway, she contacted me back and said, Little Rays has a nature center in Ottawa, and she's the veterinarian in charge there. And she checks all the animals as a volunteer. And she thought that would be the best place for him while we figured out a solution for this little guy. So I contacted Lee at the nature center, and he said that this was an unusual case, and they usually seem to get calls about reptiles and snakes, but he would be very happy to help. So he even said that they would come and pick up the animal, which was a great help because this is such a busy time for us. Anyway, he came and we had him all packed up, his bags packed and everything, and off he went.
While reptiles or amphibians sometimes slip into Canada, this case involving a mammal is a less common occurrence, according to Parker.
So with mammals in Canada, I mean, I've been in Canada for 17 years, going on 18 years, and we often get smaller animals like reptiles and amphibians come through, and they often come through either in fruit or flowers and things like that. Which is a little bit, I mean, it's not, you don't get it every month or so on, but I mean, we do hear it, and there's often probably a lot of them that don't even survive, because they often put chillers on the flowers or the fruit and stuff, and food goes into cold storage and things like that, and a lot of these animals probably won't survive. But for mammals, in the time that I've been at Little Rays, this is our first one that I'd heard of coming through like this, but I'm sure it's not the only case of it.
The caca missile was transferred to Little Rays Nature Center just before the long weekend. Now safely housed at Little Rays, work is being done to determine its origin and what next steps can be taken.
So really the process that we have when something like this comes in, when I got the call from Susan, I mean, Susan does a lot of rescue for native species. And when you have something that's exotic coming in or from another country, you have to be cautious about cross-contamination, especially if you're having animals going back into the wild. So she reached out to me saying, would the Little Rays be able to take this animal on so that it had a place to go, and then we could either try and figure out a way to get it back to where it came from, or if not that, and it couldn't leave Canada, then where would we be able to find a forever home for this animal should it need to be there? So the steps that have happened right now is that I've gone through the CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency. They deal with balls as well as food and things like into Canada. And I was on a call with them 3 times yesterday, and they obviously don't get this either. So they are working through this currently with me to find out what the best option is and what the steps going forward is with this animal. Since then, we have reached out to a facility that is willing to take it should the CFIA deem that fit for the animal. But at this point in time, it is in our quarantine. We are maintaining him. He's eating. He's a wild animal, so he's not used to people. So we're keeping him under as little stress as possible. We're not overactive in the habitat or anything like that. We go in, we do our routine maintenance of cleaning, feeding, and water changing and stuff like that, monitoring, make sure he's okay. And then once we hear back from the CFIA, we can then proceed with steps for any further veterinary care, whether he needs to have rabies vaccinations, a body checkup, make sure everything's where it needs to be, maybe make sure there's no other illnesses, or maybe some blood work and things like that before he actually gets moved on to his forever home. If he ends up finding out where he came from, and that's what the CFIA are trying to do, to see exactly where this container came from in the United States, Mexico area, that's where these guys are found, because some of these animals in certain areas are critically endangered. So obviously if this is an animal in that situation, we would rather get this animal back to where he came from. And that's what we're working on currently.
While Sandy Pines will be getting back to business as usual, mostly with native species, they remain committed to helping in any way they can with the resolution, whether that means a return to the wild or a safe new home.
Well, they said they had a nice big area for him with some trees in it, so he would be safe in there until they could figure out something. Some department of the government is going to have to be involved. And if he is being sent anywhere, we will have to get permits and jump through a lot of hoops. But we'll do our best for this little guy. But at least I know he's in a safe place and he's under veterinary care.
At their monthly meeting on Thursday, June 19th, the Kingston Police Service Board received a presentation on a new community drug checking program that has already shown promise in improving public health and safety in the region. The initiative is part of Ontario's drug checking community, a leader in the delivery of these services and community-led monitoring of the unregulated drug supply. The program was launched by Toronto's Drug Checking Service in 2019. The program offers drug users the ability to have their unregulated drugs tested before consumption to ensure they're not contaminated or in unexpected concentration. It also provides a snapshot of the unregulated drug supply market in Kingston, data that is made available to all those impacted and the general public through emergency alerts and monthly reports. Kingston became the first jurisdiction outside of Toronto to join the initiative in November 2024. With the long-term goal of establishing at least one drug checking site in each of Ontario's 29 public health unit regions. Locally, the program operates through the Integrated Care Hub on Montreal Street. Karen McDonald, Executive Director of Toronto's Drug Checking Service and Ontario's Drug Checking Community, presented an in-depth overview of the program structure, impact, and findings.
So our program is made up of three groups. There are collection sites, analysis sites, and then the central operating team. So collection sites are community agencies that are exempted to collect samples from and share results with service users. Their, you know, main role, like the Integrated Care Hub, is just to, you know, have existing and trusted relationships with people who use drugs, collect samples, share results, and really educate their communities about what it is that's circulating. Next, we have analysis sites. So these are the purple. We currently have three. These are clinical research or government labs that are exempted to analyze samples and report drug checking results. And we're super fortunate. These are, you know, scientific experts who are incredibly skilled at determining the composition of really any specimen, and we're using drugs. And then we have the central operating team. So that's the team that I run at St. Michael's Hospital, super small team. Our job is really just to make the lives of the collection sites and the analysis sites easier.
Justine McIsaac, Coordinator of Consumption and Treatment Services at Kingston's ICH, offered context on the implementation of the program in Kingston.
Just to give you some context as to why we decided to start drug checking in our community is because we have a bunch of people that are very unwell and are using substances that are very dangerous to not only the people that use them, but the greater community. And our goal with this program was to give people a better knowledge of what it was they were using, as well as the community. Initially, I piloted a project with a local group through Queens, which was called Spectra Plasmatics. I helped them write a grant to Health Canada to pilot their equipment with the support of the municipality as well. In turn, that allowed me to get the equipment for free, which is a $30,000 piece of equipment. And I have worked on that relationship with them since. The machine itself takes a very small amount of the substance or a piece of equipment that person has used to inject the substance, and we will test that, and it'll tell us exactly what is in the substance that the person used.
McIsaac, drawing from firsthand experience at the ICH, emphasized that the program had an immediate life-saving impact.
Somebody presented a substance to me that looked like MDMA, which is considered a party drug. It's very casually used amongst young people in college, universities, things like that. This drug presented as if it was what it was, and it was not. It looked like MDMA. It was stamped as if it was MDMA, and it turned out to be pill-pressed fentanyl. Now, the risks for that individual who has no opioid dependency whatsoever, that would have been consequential and most likely would have resulted in death for that individual if they had not come in and tested that drugs. Because he brought that sample in and I was able to test it, I was able then to work with public health and formulate a community alert to warn people that there were substances in our community that looked like something else, but actually weren't what they were presenting to be.
In her presentation, McDonald shared what they've uncovered about the unregulated drug supply. The primary focus was on fentanyl and other opioids. While a common fear is party drugs being laced with fentanyl, the more common case is fentanyl being contaminated with other substances or having unpredictable concentration.
We have checked over 8,000 samples that were not expected to be opioids, and we've actually only confirmed fentanyl or another high-potency opioid in 11 of those. So certainly not to say that it doesn't happen. The risks are incredibly high, but I do think there's just this general conception that this happens all the time. And what kind of worries me about that messaging is just that we're detracting from the population of people who are actually at risk. If we're putting all of our focus on, you know, people who use cocaine and MDMA and their risk of being contaminated by fentanyl, we're kind of ignoring the population of people who actually are at risk and dying.
In Toronto, only 3% of fentanyl samples tested were found to contain what users believed they were consuming. Although fewer samples have been collected in Kingston to date, the trend is similar.
And on the Kingston front, not a single fentanyl sample that has been collected by the Integrated Care Hub since we launched this service has met service users' expectations. So every single sample has been contaminated with unexpected drugs.
Fentanyl samples are often contaminated with other high-potency opioids, as well as central nervous system and respiratory depressants like benzodiazepines and animal tranquilizers. McIsaac noted that this contamination significantly impacts operations at the ICH, especially complicating overdose responses.
When we first opened, an opioid overdose response was pretty cut and dry. Now it has become so complicated that we've had to change our whole process of how we respond to overdoses to ensure that we're keeping people as safe as possible. So we're constantly on a learning curve as to how we can treat people appropriately and keep them as safe as possible.
In addition to contamination, the strength of fentanyl in the unregulated supply is highly unpredictable, with concentrations fluctuating drastically.
For one thing, what does that mean for the person who's using the drug? Are they experiencing withdrawal? But also think about if you were to flip it the other way. Someone's tolerance is kind of down because the fentanyl supply is quote unquote weaker. And then suddenly the next month it increases by 5 times the amount. Of course, the risk of overdose is going to be higher.
Members of the Kingston Police Service Board recently visited the collection site at the ICH. Board member Adam Coven remarked on the strong trust that has developed between service providers and people seeking services, a key factor in the program's effectiveness.
Going to the site yesterday was amazing for so many reasons, but one of the things that I applaud is that here in Kingston, which is the only center that we know of, the amount of trust that obviously has gone on because of your services, your staff, your support, without breaching that trust to the people that are coming to you, which amazes me. I'm standing there with the chief and deputy police, and we have people that you're saying are coming in with their drugs and their testing. It's an amazing amount of trust.
Board Chair Jared Stearns asked the first question in the Q&A portion of the presentation.
If fentanyl is like so dirty or unpredictable, why is it the drug of choice for so many people?
Unfortunately, the population that I work with has opioid dependency, so they're physically dependent on it. Primarily, the population before bootleg fentanyl was introduced to the market, primarily people were using OxyContin. It was overprescribed. But we didn't see near the amount of deaths associated because it was prescription grade. People developed a tolerance to it. They knew how to dose themselves appropriately. This is kind of what's available in the illicit market. And really, it's, in my opinion, people just taking advantage of very vulnerable, sick people in the long run. But yeah, it's not necessarily about choice. It's about there's no other option for people in the illicit market. Obviously, from a treatment perspective, as a support worker, I'm always looking for ways and means to reduce people's risk of either their use or overdose, whether it be through methadone, Suboxone, Sublocade, things like that. But it's unfortunately, it's not a choice at this point. It's what's on the market.
And are you seeing overdoses daily?
Yes.
When asked how this information can be used to find and remove the toxic drug supply, McDonald and McIsaac both stated that this would require larger solutions, but the program can still be a level of intervention.
From my perspective, the supply is always going to be toxic if it's unregulated. I'm not sure, like at this time, what our service and police can do to really like clean up the supply. Interestingly, what we have seen is that one of the primary things that people, service users do with their results is go back to the person they bought their drugs from and put kind of what we call grassroots pressure on the supply. So going back to someone and saying, I bought this, but I'm actually getting this. I don't want this thing. I'm either not going to use it. I'm going to go find it from someone else, or at least just like providing that feedback. So like that's there as well.
And just sharing the knowledge with each other too. Like I said, you know, ensuring that our constables that are out on road dealing with people every day, they have an understanding of what's going on in community and behaviors associated to drug use and are well equipped to try and support and deal with some of that.
Finally, when asked what message they most wanted Kingston police to take away, McDonald and McIsaac offered the following.
Watching how complex people's mental health and substance use needs have become, I've also watched in the years that I've been doing this work, the expectations of police on road grow to an unrealistic expectation. I've watched police become police to crisis workers, to triage workers, to finding people shelter, to dealing with complex mental health and substance use needs, to responding to overdoses. This is really, I feel like, has really impacted policing. And so first off, I'd like to thank you guys for everything that you do. But I think the takeaway is that for me in working with this complex population is that, and please forgive me, but the intent is to get high, not to die. People are seeking momentary relief from like excruciating physical, mental, and emotional pain. And it's really the bigger picture as to what happened to these people along the way. It's not necessarily what's wrong with you. It's what happened to you and how much we need to invest in caring for a very vulnerable, complex population and looking for ways and means to help them not only deal with the traumas that they carry, but feel supported and accepted and develop new coping techniques for themselves. Unfortunately, drugs have a functional purpose for some people, and generally they start using drugs because they served a purpose for them. But as I've watched people go through this very complex, hard lifestyle, I've seen it create more chaos, more trauma, more hurt for these individuals, and it really doesn't get them any further. So I think the takeaway should be is, A, we need to be a lot kinder to our police that are doing the best they can in a community or communities with little resources to help this crisis, but that people are not enjoying this. They're not out living a free-for-all. This is not them not wanting to be better or not wanting to work or not wanting to have housing. It's their needs are just so complex and they're just really sick, hurting people. And we need to remember that day in and day out, that these are still members of our community that need love and acceptance.
I guess key takeaways from me would be First, that we need to accept in rare cases, fentanyl is not what is contaminating other things. In fact, it is fentanyl that is contaminated, and that is really what is driving this crisis. And, you know, we really do need timely and accessible information about what is circulating in the drug supply and public information, you know, regardless of whether you're focused on community safety, harm reduction, treatment, prevention, understanding what it is that's in the drug supply is crucial. So I think just like, you know, the more information that we can try to generate and make publicly available and then just really work together to respond. There is no, you know, there is no single response to this crisis clearly, and it is persisting. So I think, yeah, just as much collaboration as possible, kind of, you know, and just recognizing that everybody's doing their best, but also recognizing the incredibly important role that like each different stakeholder plays.
That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for CFRC's afternoon lineup.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Egg Salad, a brand new release from local jazz musician Oscar Evans. This is an original jazz composition mixing Brazilian rhythms with classic American swing styles. A bold and funky musical exploration featuring some of Kingston's finest jazz players. Catch Oscar literally everywhere and anywhere in Kingston and keep up with the latest by following him on Instagram at Oscar Mayfield Evans. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Egg Salad by Oscar Evans on your favorite platforms and enjoy it with us now here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
What do you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better? Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.9 FM. We play all kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Hey, hey, hey! You want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University.